This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Carrie Goldberg in for Meghna Chakrabarty.
In our Week in Review today, the trial of James Whitey Bulger finally begins in earnest. Boston's most famous gangster faces charges of murder, extortion, and racketeering amid big questions about who helped him.
How Whitey was able to terror everybody for 30 years, murder, manipulate, extort. Why the government or the FBI sat back and didn't do a damn thing about it.
Also this week, tough questions from Congress about the Boston Marathon bombings to outgoing FBI Director Robert Mueller.
You said things like the FBI did an excellent job, did a thorough job, don't know what else we could have done. According to the Russians, there's a great deal more that could have been done.
And as the U.S. Senate campaign approaches its final week, President Obama comes to town to support the Democrat, Congressman Ed Markey.
Is it good for Markey or for Republican Gabriel Gomez?
Congressman Markey is extremely scary. You don't have the President of the United States, the busiest person in the world, take time out of his schedule to try to prop up Congressman Markey.
And remembering the late former Massachusetts Governor Paul Cellucci.
Paul proved that in the blood sport of Massachusetts politics, you can be a truly good and decent person and succeed at the highest levels.
And we'll talk about those stories and more with two members of our Week in Review panel. Joining us now is Callum Borchers. He's the business reporter for the Boston Globe. Hi, Callum. Great to have you back.
Great to be with you, Anthony.
And with us from Washington, D.C. today is Nancy Gertner. She's a Harvard Law School professor and a former federal judge from Massachusetts. And Nancy, great to have you. Thanks for coming back to Radio Boston.
Thanks a lot.
So let's start with a big trial of Boston mobster James Bulger, which began in earnest this week. With a jury impaneled, federal prosecutors said Bulger was a hands-on killer who led an extensive criminal enterprise. He's accused of 19 murders, racketeering, extortion, while overseeing Boston's criminal underworld for decades. In his opening statement, Bulger's defense attorney, James Carney, countered that the prosecution's key witnesses, some of whom are former gangsters, are unreliable. He said while Bulger made millions of dollars in crime and paid off corrupt law enforcement officers, he was not an FBI informant.
Well, I hope to give people a perspective of what Boston was like in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and how it was that Jim was able to operate with complete impunity.
And Nancy Gertner, I'd love to start with you. There's Jay Carney admitting that his client was a gangster, but trying to shift the focus to corruption in Boston among law enforcement agents who aided his reign of terror. What struck you about the proceedings in this first week?
Well, I think that what his opening statement does is what he has to do, and he knows that there will be no dispute about it. In other words, usually the question of what you do in an opening statement is something you want to not disclose anything that you otherwise, you know, that the other side doesn't know about. And it's perfectly clear the two things that have to be done here for the defense. One is to shift the focus on the misconduct allegations against the FBI, which have been in the air for the past 10, 15 years. And then in addition to use that to suggest that the three principal witnesses against Bulger, who are the ones whom I believe tie him to the murders, which are the most serious accusations, that those three are not to be believed, not to be trusted, etc. So, you know, there's a certain amount you can try in this case and a certain amount you can't try in this case. And he's clearly doing all he can to try what he can.
Mm. Callum, I'd love to get your response about what you observed in this first week of the trial.
Well, I was struck, Anthony, by some of the concessions that Carney was willing to make, perhaps more than we even expected. You know, the U.S. Attorney, Assistant U.S. Attorney Brian Kelly, one of the first things he mentioned in his opening remarks was, you know, you're going to hear this myth that Whitey Bulger was not involved in drug dealing in South Boston. And then, you know, Carney comes and says, no, actually, we're willing to admit that. He definitely did run a criminal enterprise that included drug dealing. But, you know, as Nancy said, the real story here, though, he's almost trying to say you're missing the point. The point here isn't what Bulger was up to. The point is how widespread, how deep the corruption was in law enforcement.
Mm. Nancy, I'm curious to hear from you how you view this trial as a former federal judge. Judge Denise Casper has a big job ahead of her. We've already seen this week she had to contain some real fireworks in the courtroom between government prosecutors and James Carney. What's the biggest challenge that she faces looking forward? I mean, if you were presiding over this trial, what would be keeping you awake at night?
The entire trial would be keeping me awake at night. I don't think I'd sleep the entire time. But, I mean, I think I think it's two things. On the one hand, controlling the parties is terribly important. The jury doesn't want to watch lawyers yelling at one another. But on the other hand, a lot is at stake here on both sides, and the enterprise is to exercise control while at the same time being fair.
Yeah.
You know, moving the case is terribly important, but this is not an easy case to try. There are lots of complex issues. If you have to slow it down for the purposes of figuring out what's the right answer, slow it down for the purpose of figuring out the right answer. I think that's the challenge. You know, you can always make the trains run on time. You can always enforce rules that will move the case along and quiet the lawyers. The issue is what's fair to both sides.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I think people have to step back and realize how complex this case is to try. So, you know, she's going to have some time to, there may be times that something will come up and she'll say, you know, hold off, let me figure this out. And that's more power to her for that.
Callum, it sounds like a huge challenge for Judge Casper. I mean, I think if I had to choose, I'd rather be reporting on this trial rather than trying to keep it on track for the next 4 months. What do you think?
Amen to that, although I don't think that our team over at the courthouse has an easy job either.
Not at all. Well, listeners, yeah, you can keep up with all the developments in the trial at bulger.wbur.org, where you can follow our live blog and learn more about all of the elements of this long and complex story. So, Nancy and Callum, let's move on to testimony by outgoing FBI Director Robert Mueller before the House Judiciary Committee. Among other things, he was asked about the Boston Marathon bombings and about whether the FBI could have done more to prevent them. Here's Congressman Louie Gohmert of Texas.
The FBI never canvassed Boston mosques until 4 days after the April 15th attacks. If the Russians tell you that someone has been radicalized and you go check and see the mosque where these Tsarnaevs attended, and then when you have the pictures, why did no one go to the mosque and say, who are these guys? Why was that not done since such a thorough job was done?
Now, Mueller counted that the FBI did visit the mosques before the marathon bombings, but he also admitted that a lack of internal communication within the FBI might have prevented the agency from alerting Russian authorities about bombing suspect Tamerlan Tsarnaev's trip back to Russia before the bombings, which Russian officials say might have averted the attacks if they had had that information. Mueller disagreed with that. Callum, complicated sort of back and forth, but what do we learn this week about what the FBI could have done, should have done better prior to the bombings?
Well, we've talked a little bit in the past, Anthony, about this difference between, you know, very deliberate communication and sort of passive communication. And that was one of the complaints, you remember, of Police Commissioner Ed Davis when he was testifying in Washington. Well, maybe we had access to certain information within a database, but it's just so vast that unless we're sort of directed what to look at, it doesn't really mean a whole lot. And I think that that's really what we saw illuminated here, was sort of the FBI's acknowledgement that communication procedures, there was going to be no informality anymore. They are going to be very deliberate about what they communicate within their own agency and also what they communicate to sort of branches like the Boston Terrorism Joint Task Force.
Mm. Nancy, there have been calls recently from the Boston Globe's editorial page for a sort of full inquiry into the bombings and the aftermath, the response to them. Do you think we're getting closer to a full understanding of what happened and whether changes in law enforcement systems are needed?
I think that there are two questions in your one question. I mean, on the one hand, are we getting closer to what happened and what could have happened? And, you know, yes, we're getting closer, and that's a good thing to do to try to find out what, you know, channels of communication should have been opened, what information should have been circulated. But we do have to step back. There's only a certain amount that, in fact, can be prevented, particularly when you're dealing with, you know, homegrown, not international. He may have been radicalized in Dagestan, but it's not at all clear that he was at the – actually, there's no evidence that he was at the direction or at the behest of anyone abroad. So while we should look at the bottom of this and try to, you know, make our intelligence processes better, I do think we have to also step back and say it's not clear any of this would have made a difference.
Yeah. Do you agree with that, Callum?
I do, because, I mean, you think about this assertion that, oh, if we had alerted the Russians that he made the trip to Dagestan, perhaps that would have prevented the attack. You know, I'm reminded of what Representative Stephen Cohen, the Tennessee Democrat, said this week, right? And he was like, well, you know, maybe we would have prevented it because maybe the Russians would have killed him, you know?
Right.
And
right.
You know, while we could all look back now with 2020 hindsight and say, okay, well, I, guess I would be okay with that. But, I mean, really, is that the solution here, that when somebody has suspicious travel patterns that we want the Russians to go kill them for us? I'm not sure that's really what we're looking for.
Right, yeah. And there's so much about this story that is bizarre, about the motivation even that is bizarre, that, you know, as I said, it's not clear you could prevent the Fort Hood shooter, and there's some that you can't prevent. Doesn't mean you don't try. Doesn't mean you do everything that you can do. But it also means that we don't sort of reorganize our government and our processes, anticipating that we can prevent what we can't.
Well, let's move on. Just over 1 week to go to the special U.S. Senate election in Massachusetts. President Obama was in Roxbury yesterday to support the Democrat Congressman Ed Markey. Here he is urging voters not to take this election for granted.
We got a whole lot of Democrats in this state and a whole lot of Obama voters. But you can't just turn out during a presidential election. You've got to turn out in this election.
Now, for his part, Republican Gabriel Gomez used the president's appearance to suggest that despite what the polls say, this race is close.
I'm humbled that the president's here. You know, obviously he feels it's important. But it also says that Congressman Markey is extremely scared. You don't have the president of the United States, the busiest person in the world, take time out of his schedule to try to prop up Congressman Markey.
Callum, WBUR's most recent poll gives Markey a pretty comfortable 7-point lead. But to Gomez's point, Markey might not be scared, but the president's visit does suggest he's taking nothing for granted here, right?
Absolutely. I mean, and I think that obviously what the Gomez campaign is going to argue is that it means that the Markey campaign is scared of him specifically. I guess another way to look at it is that what they're really scared of is poor attendance at the polls, right? They don't want Democratic voters to just assume that Markey has it in the bag and not show up. Either way, though, there's clearly some trepidation here on the Democrats' part.
Nancy, what's your view on where this Senate race stands today?
But, you know, I think it would be a different world if the Coakley race had not happened many years ago. Mm. So there is certainly a fear that in a special election, people just don't respond as they do in a regular election. There isn't enough time. People basically blow it off and don't vote. I think that that's more responsible for Bill Clinton coming, for the president coming, which is just let's make sure we take this seriously. I'm also not at all sure that in any senatorial election, given Massachusetts' centrality, you know, to the New England delegation, given the closeness of the Senate, I don't think it's such a big deal that the president and former President Clinton come to visit. You know, this is an important seat, period. So I don't think it suggests anything except, you know, where everyone is nervous about any special election because the vectors are all crazy in a special election, as we have seen. And, you know, the Senate is relatively close. So I'm not sure it forecasts, you know, doom, as Gomez would suggest.
You both mentioned former President Clinton coming to town. He'll be campaigning in town tomorrow.
Okay.
Well, let's move on. Finally this week, Paul Cellucci died at the age of 65 of Lou Gehrig's disease. He was a selectman from his hometown of Hudson who rose to become a state legislator, lieutenant governor, governor of Massachusetts, and then ambassador to Canada. He was a Republican in the bluest of blue states who cut taxes, but was also a political moderate who was pro-abortion rights, pro-gun control, emblematic, I guess, of a disappearing breed of New England Republican. Here's Andrew Card, a former White House counselor and close friend of Cellucci's, remembering him yesterday.
He is the personification of the noble public servant. He gave the Commonwealth quiet, firm leadership during a difficult time. And in contrast to today's bombastic politics, he worked with people on both sides of the political spectrum. He managed to get things done, but he did it without really calling attention to himself.
Nancy, a lot of fond remembrances of Paul Cellucci this week. What struck you about how he was remembered, how you remember him?
Well, I think the most significant thing was that people were distinguishing between his kind of Republican, and maybe one way to describe it is a Massachusetts kind of Republican, and what we see now. I mean, I was particularly moved by people remembering him for his strength on pro-choice issues. You got the sense this was not just a knee-jerk reaction because this is what you needed to say in Massachusetts. It also didn't feel like pro-choice in the way that some recent candidates have been pro-choice, which is, I won't touch Roe v. Wade, but I'm prepared to annihilate abortion in every other way possible. I mean, he was genuinely pro-choice, pro-women's rights, and unabashed, and could be under the Republican tent even with those opinions. And that's really a dying breed.
You mentioned pro-women's rights. It's worth remembering that he elevated Jane Swift to become lieutenant governor, and when he left for Canada, that propelled her to become the state's first female governor. He also appointed Margaret Marshall as the Chief Justice of the SJC, and she would go on to write the decision that would legalize gay marriage in Massachusetts. So that's part of his legacy. Callum, what's your take on his legacy?
Well, I was struck, Anthony, by how, you know, we talk about Bill Weld Republicans in the state, right? Mm-hmm. But to hear Weld talk about it, they might just as well be called Paul Cellucci Republicans. You know, I was interested to hear him sort of pull back the curtain on that administration this week and talk about the very important role, perhaps the most active role any, you know, recent lieutenant governor has played in that administration. And he talked openly about sort of going into office and how, you know, his experience was really as a prosecutor, and how he really relied on Cellucci's knowledge of how the state worked. I think that in a lot of ways we didn't really appreciate while he was in office how influential he actually was.
Really,
and that's precisely because he wasn't a bombast. He wasn't, you know, it wasn't sort of camera angles and cute phrases. I mean, he just did the job.
Let's move on to our hubbub, that story that didn't quite make it above the fold this week. And let me start with Carrie. Carrie, well, let's hear your hubbub.
Well, Anthony, my hubbub is that I'd like to mark the passing of an extraordinary Cambridge woman, Joan Parker. She was the widow and muse of Robert Parker, mm-hmm. who wrote the widely beloved Spencer for Hire detective novels. She was a prominent philanthropist and just a kind of a live-out-loud person about many things, including the arrangement that she and Robert Parker lived on separate floors of their big Cambridge house. Joan Parker joined Radio Boston last year and talked about how influential the writings of Raymond Chandler were on Robert Parker.
The Chandler estate had picked Bob as a person to finish a, I believe, 16-page manuscript that Chandler had left before his death. But prior to writing it, he immersed himself even further in Chandler's work, including Chandler's style, which was not to outline, which he said initially was like a tightrope walking without a net.
Tightrope walking without a net. Joan Parker there, who died this week. Callum, let me come to you with your hubbub.
Well, I've been following, Anthony, as you know, this sort of back-and-forth negotiation between the Boston Redevelopment Authority and the Boston Red Sox over the rights to sell concessions during game days on Yawkey Way right next to Fenway Park. And we have a new twist this week. Meet Joe Marchese Jr. He's a guy from Everett. He's got a law practice in Revere. And he says he is willing to outbid the Red Sox for that license. Now, this is the first time that they've had any competition, and the BRA wasn't really planning on having an open bid here. The intent was to simply renegotiate and extend the existing contract with the Red Sox. But the price that Marchese says he's willing to pay is hefty. He says he's willing to pony up $3 million over 10 years to sell hot dogs and beer and whatnot on Yawkey Way. It's about double what the Sox are paying.
Really interesting story, Callum, and I appreciated your reporting on it this morning. Do we know what the BRA is saying about this?
Well, so far, they're tight-lipped. I reached out to the BRA, and, you know, as they've said in the past, they don't want to negotiate through the press, and they would neither confirm nor deny whether they're really going to take Marchese seriously. But the other interesting aspect, too, is that the state inspector general is beginning to pay attention again. I remember last year, the IG's office wrote to the BRA saying, we're not sure you're on strong legal ground to just re-up with the Red Sox, and you might be opening yourself to a lawsuit. Well, this could be that prediction coming through, and the inspector general said again this week that he favors an open bidding process mm-hmm. for the taxpayers' benefit.
Really interesting. Nancy, let me come to you for your hubbub.
Did we go from hot dogs to overheard communications? this is not a story that hasn't been covered. Obviously, we have been covering the NSA story, the story of the Verizon subpoena to America's communications, just the from and to, not all the content of the communications, and then this program called PRISM, which enables the government to find out about certain kinds of international phone calls. It's a very, very serious, evolving story. We can't get to the bottom of it yet. Two parts of it which are interesting to me. One is the fact of how much of this played out in our secret court, the FISA court. And there is something troubling about how the meets and bounds and standards can't be disclosed, so you don't even know whether there was compliance with the Constitution or with statutory authorities. We don't know. We have to assume. We're not a country that should take things on faith. Second point about that is that it is also, on the other hand, the leaker of this information. People are saying, is he a hero or is he a villain? I just think it's sort of interesting, as I think this is not a unique position that I'm taking, but it is interesting that the place that he chooses to disclose this information is China.
Yes.
Hong Kong, decry what our government is doing by going to China to announce it seemed really odd to me. And then finally, you can't help but watch the blogosphere on this. There's a wonderful comment. I don't know who it was, the comedian who started it, who said, it gives new meaning to the commercial about Verizon. Can you hear me now?
Nancy Gertner, thank you so much. Harvard Law School professor and former federal judge from Massachusetts. Thanks for that last thoughtful hubbub and for joining us today. And have a great weekend.
Thank you.
And Callum Borchers, business reporter for the Boston Globe. Always good to have you. Have a great weekend to you as well.
Likewise. Thanks for having me.
Stay with us. Up next, they say the recession is over, but for many, the effects linger. I'm Carrie Goldberg.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.